You recognize the song Happy Birthday, okay, partially because of the context that I was telling you a story about birthdays, but you also recognize the song of a birthday because it has its own discernible notes and melody, right? I'm terrible at singing. Dun, 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 dun. What is that? Thank you, brother. You saved me. Amazing Grace, right? We could play Name That Tune, and you would be able to name, if somebody was a good vocalist, you'd be able to name what song it is. So this lesson is called the melodic line. It's actually one of my favorite disciplines to bring to preaching because of how profitable it is. So this is a little musical note, okay? And the idea is very simple. I'll put it this way. Just as every song has a unique melody, so every book has a unique message. Let me say that again. Just as every song has a unique melody, so every book has a unique message. And one of the ways to ensure that there's variety in your preaching is to listen to the book. Put it differently, in some ways, the best preachers are the best listeners because they hear things that are actually in the musical notes of the text, and they bring them forth so that the congregation can see them or sing them. So what we're looking for when we think about the melodic line are, what are the notes that are unique to a particular book of the Bible? Right? So Philippians, what's a note that occurs in the book of Philippians? Somebody shout one out. Joy, right? When you think of Philippians, automatically joy will come to your mind, right? Or let's think about tone for a moment. When you think about the tone of the book of Habakkuk, what's kind of the tone of Habakkuk? What'd you say, brother? Mighty? Someone behind, did you say something? No? Okay. I'm just picking on people. What's the tone of Habakkuk? Anger. What else? Burden. What else? Despair. What else? Lament. Anybody else? Sad. There's this kind of frustration in Habakkuk's heart, right? That can come across in the preaching as you preach it. And you want it to come across. So if we're thinking about finding the melodic line of a text, one of the books of the Bible, what are some of the strategies that we could use to listen for the melody or the unique notes? Every book has a unique message, just as every song has a unique melody. What are some strategies, guys? How would you find the melodic line of a book? Okay, two guys said something. One guy said, read the book. Okay, that's great advice, right? How many times would you read it? Seven times. And then you can put it down, all right? But seven, all right? Read the book over and over and over. Read it repeatedly, right? And the other person said, what did you say? Tip and tail. Some people call it the top and tail or the tip and the tail, right? But that's read. What does that mean? Read the beginning and the end. Okay, top and tail. Read the beginning of it. That's the Cliff Notes version. If you don't want to read the whole thing seven times, just read the beginning and the end and you got it. But the top and tail can tell you something. What else? Our strategies to hear the repeated notes of a text or a book. Repeated words and phrases. Great. What's another one? How do you find the melodic line of a book? I heard you, and then what did you say, brother?
The author's intent.
Okay, the author's intent, and what Eric said is purpose statement. Okay, so sometimes the author just says, the reason why I'm writing to you is this, and tells you what it is. Purpose statement. What else? Any other ones? You can think of, yeah.
The state of mind
Okay, the state of mind that he's writing in. How would you say that another way, somebody? What's another way to say the state of mind that he's writing in? Okay. Yeah. All right, he said irony. Is your name Cody? James, sorry, James. Is that what you meant?
I meant like the context he's writing from.
Okay, the context he's writing from, the state of mind that he's writing from. Think about poetry for a moment. Poetry is intended actually to communicate to your emotional state, right? So if you read an actual English poem, the point of it is not, you know, necessarily what message is this person trying to convey, but is what message is he trying to convey, or he or she, through the images and the emotion, which might relate to the state of mind. So what I would say is, another way to say it is that there's, what is the tone or the mood of poetry? That's a really important question to ask, the tone or the mood. And then this brother over here said something about irony. I'm trying to think of a larger category for that. What did you say a second ago? Don't remember.
I just said irony, but just
okay.
The flavors, the whole
book. Right, right. So maybe I'll just put flavor or ethos of the book. Anyway, the point is, how do you find the overall musical notes of the text? And the reason why we want to do this is because if you go like this, if you do this little drawing here, first thing we're working on is the structure, then we work on the content. We're also working on the audience, the argument of the author. Along here, we're also looking for the melodic line, which is going to shape this whole thing. And what happens when you discover the melodic line is it helps you know if the point that you're using for your argument is actually in line with the message of the book. Because if it's completely out of line with the message of the book, you probably didn't find actually what the right argument is. You want to make sure that it doesn't mean that it's the same every time. Dun 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 dun. There's variation, and you might only remember a part of a song, and you keep singing it over and over again, but there's a kind of breadth and fullness to the song. So what we want to do is look for the melodic line. And we talked about these different strategies right now. There's one other one, which might be the narrator's comments. It's a little bit like the purpose statement, but you could write that down as well. Let's do top and tail very quickly. Let's do Romans 1, verses 1 to 7, and Romans 16, 25 to 27 with a partner. Just read the beginning and the end of Romans. I'll write it up here. Romans 1. 1 to 7, and Romans 16, 25 to 27. So do top and tail and ask yourself, what does this teach us about what Romans is about? Ready, go. Phrases with your partner, and then back up here in a minute. So with your partner, one more minute. Okay, Jesus, thank you, Stephen. He was in both parts. That's that Sunday school story about what's brown and has a puffy tail. It's in a Sunday school class, and the kid goes, Jesus, right? Because everything in Sunday school. It's actually a squirrel, but no, it was Jesus. What else is repeated? Okay, who said that? Say it a little louder. Listen to this brother over here.
The obedience of faith.
The obedience of faith. That's a really nuanced phrase. It's not just obedience, it's not just faith. It's the obedience of faith.
To the glory of God.
Is that in both, brother?
Well, the ends on 27, the only wise God, be glory forevermore.
Okay.
And then in 6:5, it says, for the sake of his name among all nations.
Okay, for the sake of his name among all nations, the glory of God. What else? Repeated phrases. the gospel. The gospel, all the nations, through the prophets. All right, so now if you're trying to figure out what your melodic line is, just from the top and tail and the repeated phrases, what would be a next step that you would do? You're trying to figure out the melodic line. You see how it courses through the rest of the text, right? What else? The other thing you want to do is decide which of these are, if we try to use every single one of these concepts, they're not all going to fit into a concise melodic line, right? With a partner, on your own, try to write a provisional melodic line of Romans using some of those concepts. Ready, go. This should take you like a week or a month or a lifetime to do, but you got 4 minutes. All nations are called to the obedience of faith to the glory of God. Thumbs up or thumbs down? Just kidding, we're not voting on that. Yeah, brother, back there. Thank you. That was good. Okay. The glory of God revealed in the obedience of Jesus Christ?
No.
In the gospel of Jesus Christ? For the obedience of all the nations. Good. What word was he missing that you kind of want to be in this book or in this faith? We maybe try to work that one back in. But no, that's good. That was very inclusive of the concepts, right? This is what you're trying to do when you're looking for the melodic line. It only took us 7 minutes to do that, right? It's going to take you longer on your own, and you want to keep, this is just on Monday morning, Tuesday morning, your provisional work. Anybody else want to give a shot? Okay.
All nations profit from the gospel.
Okay. He got the word profit in there even. How did you spell that this time? All right, so at the moment now is not to decide which one's right or which one's wrong or something. The moment now is to learn how to do this exercise by listening. Does that make sense? Turn to the Gospel of John. Browse through the Gospel of John. Where are you going to find, with your partner, look for the melodic line of John. Choose a strategy. It didn't go as well as you wanted. So you woke up at like 4 a.m. You're like, I got to get started on my sermon for this week. And you're going in the Gospel of John. And so you start flipping through and you're beginning to think about melodic line. What's one strategy for the Gospel of John that you might employ to find the melodic line? Yeah. Yeah, purpose statement. And where would you find the purpose statement, brother? Okay, John 20, 31. And what does it say? Yeah. So the Gospel of John is a really sweet and beautiful place to look for the melodic line because it's so clear and straightforward. What are some other books that have clear purpose statements to them? 1 John. Yep. Where would we find it in 1 John? 5:13. What's another book that has a clear purpose statement? So 1 John, where else? Luke would be one. Yeah, where would you find it in Luke? The first four verses, Luke 1, 1 to 4. Somebody read that out loud for us, okay?
Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us, this is those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministered the word that have delivered them to us. It seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account of you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may have certainty concerning the things you have been taught.
Right, so in Luke, it's pretty clear in the Gospel of Luke why he's writing What's one or two aspects of why he's writing in the Gospel of Luke? What's that? To report, yes. What else?
Assurance.
Where do we see assurance, brother?
That you may know.
That you may know. And what did the translation he just read say? That you may have certainty. Another word would be confidence, right? To report, but also for confidence. That's why he's writing these things. What's another book that has a purpose statement? First Timothy, yes. Where's the purpose statement in First Timothy? 3:14-15. Can somebody read 1 Timothy 3:14-15?
I hope to come to you soon, but I write these things to you so that if I delay, you may know how one must behave in the household of God, which is the church of the living God, a pillar of life.
Okay, I'm writing these things to you so that if I'm delayed, you might know how to behave in the household of God. So what where we would go from there is, where else does it speak of the household of God, for instance, in the book of 1 Timothy? And what is the context of what's happening there? So that's another example of a purpose statement. On 1 Timothy, turn there, everybody, and let's just look at that real quickly again. There's something interesting in 1 Timothy that I want us to look at. Can you read that again, brother?
I hope to come to you soon, but I am writing these things to you so that if I delay, you may know how one ought to behave in the household of God, which is the church of the living God, pillar and buttress of the truth.
What does it say about the church in this purpose statement? It's right there. Just say it, somebody. It's the pillar. What's a pillar and a buttress? What is it? What's the function of a pillar and a buttress?
Structure.
Structure, yes. What?
Support.
So the church is supporting what? So you, to draw it, it would be like this: the truth, and this is a buttress. Okay, isn't it beautiful? That's like a Corinthian pillar. I know it's beautiful. There's the church. Now, is that normally what you think the role of the church is being in relation to the truth? Normally, Paul talks about the truth or the Bible or the gospel being the foundation of the church. Does that make sense? Right? In Ephesians, that's what he says. He talks about the prophets and the apostles with Jesus Christ as the cornerstone, as the foundation. So there's something interesting going on here, which is that you want to find out in your study. What's going on? Why is the church upholding the truth? It's actually the behavior of the church. And what he's writing to, he's giving some church governance principles, right? You need deacons. You need elders. They need to be qualified. Why does he talk so much about them being qualified? Because they uphold the truthfulness of the gospel. What happens if you have an elder who doesn't meet the qualifications of the church? Okay, your church is only as strong as your weakest link. What happens, culturally speaking, if elders don't meet up to their qualifications, culturally speaking? They lose their testimony, right? And this is what we're seeing in our wider culture is, when a pastor fails, there's an impact on the truthfulness of the gospel among people, right? So part of what we're calling you ourselves to is preaching to the church in a way that upholds the truth. That's a strategy. Luke, John, 1 Timothy. Let's turn to Ecclesiastes, right? Everybody to Ecclesiastes. So we're looking for melodic lines. Our strategy, we talked about repeated words, we talked about purpose statements. If you're turning to, as you turn to Ecclesiastes, just kind of flip to it, or flip through it, and look for some provisional keys to the melodic line in Ecclesiastes. With your partner, ready, go. phases we're trying. All right? What's another strategy? Words and phrases. Also tried top and tail. Let's do words and phrases first. What do we find in the book of Ecclesiastes that's going to tell us a little bit about the meaning or the melodic line? Vanity. How many times does vanity occur in the book of Ecclesiastes? A lot. Maybe more. At least a lot. Maybe more. Right? All right. Let's pause for a second. What kind of genre, what genre or text type even, is Ecclesiastes? Let's do text type. What text type is it? Say it louder, somebody.
Poetry.
Poetry, right? Poetry. How is meaning communicated in poetry? By imagery, yes, by stanzas. So let's stay on. You've come across Ecclesiastes. You're thinking about preaching it. You're like, I don't know if I could do this book, right? Let me go find a commentary. And you start to work at it. What is the one of our Hebrew scholars give us the Hebrew word for that's translated as vanity?
Hevel.
Okay, hevel. Let's pause for a second. So with poetry, you're asking yourself, what is the image? What is the actual translation of the word hevel or chavel?
Smoke or vaping?
Smoke or vaping? I didn't hear what you said. Smoke, vapor,
breath.
Any other translations? Wind. All right. Now, with an image, what you do with an image is you're asking yourself, what does the image convey? So what are some characteristics of the words on the left that you could write about meaning on the right? What are some of the characteristics of smoke, vapor, breath? Let me add one more. Mist. Okay, transitory. What's that?
Invisible.
What else? Transitory, invisible.
Substanceless.
Okay, substanceless. Substanceless. You're just trying to make me have to misspell up here. Substance list. Anything else? What else? Okay, let's pause for a second. You see a mist. Hold on one sec. What did you say?
Fleeting.
You see a mist. It's in the morning. And the mist is arising over a lake that you're near. What are... this? Sorry. You're in a desert. There's no water. You see a mirage over there. And you're like, there's water over there. Right? Thank you. That's called contextualization. Right? I didn't realize where I was for a second. What is water? People are wanting to know. All right, take the idea of a mirage for a second. What are some of the qualities of a mirage? Is it fleeting? Yes, we already said that, so that's good. Is it invisible? No, it's actually not invisible. It might become invisible, but at first it's visible. What else? It's an illusion? It's in a what?
Illusion.
An illusion, is that what you said? Yeah, it's an illusion. It's also deceptive, right? Yeah, it's deceptive. Yeah, it is pointless to chase after, which is the primary meaning that the ESV and most translations have gone for, meaninglessness. But if it's confined to only meaninglessness, what are you missing? What's that? See, actually, this is interesting. Because the ESV is an essentially literal translation. And so what the ESV intends to do is to translate every Hebrew word and every Greek word as closely as possible to its actual image. So, for instance, in Ephesians, instead of saying live according to the gospel, it says walk, right? It uses the imagery of walk. Here, they use a word that's meaninglessness, which is actually, it's not really a translation of the image. It's a translation of the meaning. Does that make sense? But if you just stop here for a moment and think about, run that through for a second, life is blank, and shout out a sentence to us that relates to the missed sense. So give me a sentence. Life is what? Use one of those up there.
Temporary.
Life is temporary. That is certainly an aspect of what Ecclesiastes is about. Life is there for a moment, and then it's gone. What else? Life is uncontrollable, yeah. It's like this, you can't grab onto the mist. What else?
Fleeting.
It's fleeting, right? It's here and then it's gone. It can also be deceptive. You think it's about this and it's about, some of the injustice passages in Ecclesiastes are about, God, why do the wicked prosper? Like what, something is out of sync with how the world is supposed to be. Anyway, what I'm trying to demonstrate here on Ecclesiastes is that the melodic line, you can get a part of it by drilling into the meaning of the image, right? Let's do top and tail for a second on this book. So read the first few verses of Ecclesiastes and then the last few verses of Ecclesiastes as well. Read verses 1 to 3 of chapter 1, and then chapter 12, 8 and 11 to 14. Ecclesiastes 1, 1 to 3. And Ecclesiastes 12, verse 8 and then 11 to 14. And you ask yourself, what does the top and tail teach you? All right, what are you learning from the beginning and the end? And you're like, we didn't even get to the second part. So, did you guys have a chance to look at the end and the beginning? Your table? Did you guys look at both? So, what are you noticing from the beginning and the end that will influence your understanding of the melodic line? All is vanity. Who said that? Okay, thank you. All is vanity or all is a mist. The literal translation would be all is breath. All is a vapor. What else are you learning?
That the only thing that isn't vanity is to worship God and obey His commandments.
Okay, the only thing that isn't vanity is to worship God and obey His commandments. What else? Somebody else. Okay, listen to the preacher. In a world of transience, in a world of meaninglessness, in a world where life is taken like that, listen to the preacher. Take a look at verse 11 of chapter 12. The words of the wise are like goads, like nails firmly fixed are the collected sayings. They are given by one shepherd. What's a goad, somebody? It's a prod. It's like a pointy stick to move cattle with. And he's saying that the words, as opposed to being substanceless and illusory and temporary, the word is a stick that will poke people where they need to go. And what's the second word, the second image there? These guys have a joke over here. We need to hear your joke. Okay. Okay. It was a mist-like joke. What's the second image in Ecclesiastes 12:11? Nail. And what about the nail?
Firm.
It's firm. How firm is it? Firmly fixed. Like, another way to think of this, you guys, is like, there's something that you can hang your whole life on, which is a word, which is the word. And if you look back at chapter 1, I only had you look to verse 3, but look at verse 4. A generation goes and a generation comes, but earth remains forever. It's on that transient side of it. Ecclesiastes is so much about the rhythms of life just coming and going and the elusiveness of it. Look at Ecclesiastes 3. For everything there's a season, a time to be born under heaven. A time for every matter under heaven. Time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill, a time to heal. Think about the last 18 months. That's what's been happening. You read articles in The Atlantic this week that evangelicalism is being dismantled. It's being torn down. But as something is being torn down, something else is being built up. We've seen so much death in the last 18 months. And also, we've had 22 births in our church in the last 15 months, right? COVID pregnancies. Anyway, speaking of the transience and the rhythm of life and where is meaning found, what are some of the other repeated phrases in the book of Ecclesiastes? There's a couple others that we could just mention. Under the sun. Which is, under the sun is a way of speaking of the secular view of life without reference to God. What's another repeated phrase?
Wisdom.
Seek wisdom. What else? Toil. And the transienceness or the lack of productivity of toil. I work, I work, I work. And then my money goes to the next person who comes into the world. It's a great book for our culture today, Ecclesiastes is, right? And we went to the meaning by looking at these strategies, using these strategies. Does Ecclesiastes sound like Philippians? No. Does Philippians sound like Habakkuk? No. Does Jonah sound like Habakkuk? No. So why does your preaching sound the same every week? I'm teasing, but why does our preaching sound the same every week? There's, again, this is what I think Paul means by that he gets to preach the unsearchable riches of Christ. That there's beauty in what Ecclesiastes is saying, and there's beauty in what Habakkuk is saying. Let's do Philippians very quickly. Turn to Philippians. So what did we say is one of the repeated phrases in Philippians? Let's just do it all together. Joy. Shout out where joy occurs. Just shout one out.
Verse 4,
read it out loud.
Always in every prayer of mine before you all, making my prayer with joy.
Okay, making my prayer with joy. What's another one?
Humility.
I'm talking about joy. What's another occurrence of joy? Sorry. Read another occurrence of joy.
Four,
can you read it, Kevin?
Joy.
Okay. Good. Now let's use one of our other disciplines, the historical method, the historical context. What do we know about the historical context of Philippians? He's in prison. Paul is in prison, right? He's in, say it again. Philippi is a Roman colony. What do you think the ethos or the spiritual state of the Philippian church is at this moment? Probably not joyful. Maybe a little, why would they be discouraged in the texts? Paul, their leader, is in jail. What's another repeated theme in the book of Philippians? We did joy. What's another one?
Partnership.
Humility. Sorry, I need my pen. It left me, no. It was in the book of Ecclesiastes. So joy is one of them. Humility is another, and then partnership. Where do you see partnership?
Verse 3, chapter 1, and then chapter 4.
3, chapter 1, and then chapter 4. Did you say 3, 1?
I'm sorry, 1, 3, and then throughout chapter
4. 1, 3, chapter 4, throughout. Anywhere else? Does partnership come out anywhere else? 2, 1. 127. 219. The word there, the Greek word is koinonia. And so some of the times it's translated partnership, participation, fellowship. So when Paul mentions it in chapter 3, he talks about koinonia in the sufferings of Christ. So now try to put those together. Try to take either humility and partnership and put them together with your partner. See if you can come up with a provisional melodic line with your partner using some of these words. Knowing the historical context, you have a week to do it, but I'll give you 3 minutes. Ready, go. What is your theme of Philippians? Somebody be bold. Help us out. What's a theme sentence, Stephen, for Philippians? Go ahead. Okay. Partner with me as I imitate Christ with joy and humility. Thank you. Somebody else.
True joy is found through partnership in Christ's humility.
Okay, true joy is found through partnership in Christ's humility. Got it? So that's what you're working on, I'd say, on Monday morning. You're thinking about preaching, and you're working on that sentence. What one of my colleagues and I, we were preaching through the book of Philippians, and we couldn't agree on what the theme was, and so we didn't know what to title it, you know. And I'm like, how can you not say something about joy in the title? Because it's like everywhere. And he's like, that's not the theme. That is not the melodic line, you know. This isn't Dave Helmos, another pastor. So he kept saying that it was a partnership in the gospel. So our compromise was the joy of partnership in the gospel. Which I do think is pretty close to what it's about. That Paul keeps emphasizing, no, it's great. We're one with Christ. Look at his humility. Look at his resurrection. We get to be called to be like him. We're one with him. And the gospel's moving forward. So be joyful. Why are you guys so discouraged? The gospel's going forward even though I'm in jail right now. It's about his joy of partnering in the gospel and his desire to continue to move it forward. All right. Let's do Jonah, and then we'll be done. What are some clues in Jonah that you would use, or some strategies that you would use in Jonah? Some clues in Jonah. Some strategies or clues in Jonah. Go ahead, anybody, shout them out. This will just be together.
Words.
Say it again. Repeated words. Another strategy. What are some of the repeated words in Jonah? Okay, God appointed. Anger. The word of the Lord came. What else? What's that? Go to. I'm going to use a different strategy here for a second and ask you to, if you were to think of one word to describe Jonah in each chapter, what word would you use to describe Jonah in chapter 1?
Overboard?
Yep. Describing him. Go ahead. Without pity, disobedient, rebellious, downward spiral. I'll put rebellious here. What is a word to describe Jonah in chapter 2? Repentant, begrudging. Somebody said something over here. Desperate. I'll put repentant.
Fearful.
What about chapter 3? What's a way to describe Jonah in chapter 3? Obedient. What's another way to describe him? Reluctant. If we want to keep with the R's, we could say reluctant, right?
Resigned.
I'll put obedient here. Did you want me to put resigned? Here, I'll give you another R, okay?
Obedient,
Obediently resigned. When Matthew 12 looks at Jonah, what does he say about Jonah? Yeah, what did you say? He's resurrected, right? Or restored. And what's chapter 4? What'd you say?
Ridiculous.
I don't think I can spell ridiculous. Is that how you spell it? Angry. What'd you say? Raging. All right, let's do this now. If you look at chapter 1, that's Jonah. And our brother over here said there's irony and there's contrast. What does chapter 1 teach you about God? Teach you about God. He's sovereign. I'm going to put that up here and say that this is part of the theme of the whole book, is sovereign, okay? He's patient. Merciful. What else? Determined. How about pursuing? Like he's precisely, I'm going after this guy. Patient. What were some of the other ones we said? Powerful. Yeah. What about chapter 2? If chapter 1 is powerful in pursuing God, what's chapter 2? What's that? Prayerful? I'm talking about God, not Jonah. He's redeeming. He's responsive. So in chapter 1, he's a pursuing God. In chapter 2, he's a forgiving God or a saving God or a delivering God. And then in chapter 3, what is he? Commissioning? What? Relenting. Yeah, he's a relenting God there. And then in chapter 4, I can't hear. Sorry, somebody say it louder. Compassionate. Patient. Or even persistent. In chapter 1, he's a pursuing God. In chapter 4, he's still pursuing. He's still thinking about the nations. And then what happens with the melodic line is it informs each one of the breaks. So like, if you think of chapter 2, verse 9c, that salvation belongs to the Lord. Each chapter is speaking a little bit differently about how salvation belongs to the Lord. All right, the point is, with melodic line, is that every song has a unique melody, so every book has a unique message. And the best preachers are the best listeners.